There seems to be the wind is blowing a different direction in Washington, D.C. these days. And the 2007 Farm Bill is not too terribly far away. We started conversations last spring, you might remember, on the air. We still have a place on the website where you can go back and listen to a number of policy issues that we spoke of. It's called Ag Policy Radio. In fact, if you just type agpolicyradio.com in, you'll get to that webpage. And you can listen to a number of things that we discussed in, I think there were seven, maybe eight different hour-long conversations we had on farm policy last spring. We're going to continue those conversations this morning right up until about 20 after the hour. We've got two very distinguished ag economists with us this morning to talk a little bit about farm policy. You know as well as I do that the WTO and Washington, D.C. are likely to change that check that comes in the mail to you, at least the reasons that it comes into the mail to you. And we're going to try to take some of that up this morning. Otto Doering from Purdue University is with us this morning. Good morning to you, Otto. Thank you for driving down from Lafayette. And Bob Thompson from the University of Illinois is with us. Both specialize in ag policy. We're going to turn things over to Bob for just a second. Is Otto starting? Okay, Otto's going to start. He's going to give us about 5 minutes, two or three topics, and then Bob's going to do two or three topics, and we're going to open up for questions at that point. Good morning, Otto. Thank you much. Glad you're here.
Good morning. Nice to be here. What I would like to do is spend about 5 minutes and talk with you a little bit about a couple things, one particularly which you don't normally think of in terms of ag policy, but I think may be one of the key drivers. What I want to talk about is the budget. Now, think back a little bit, and for those of you, and there are a few of you out there that are as old as I am, and may have gone through something called the farm financial crisis in the 80s. That farm financial crisis was not caused by a farm bill. It was caused by Paul Volcker, who came in with the beginning of the Reagan administration. We were running very high inflation. He wanted to stomp inflation, so he let interest rates take their course. The Fed didn't print money to make up the deficit. And some of you remember 14, 16, 18% interest. Those of you may also remember, a few of you, but not admit it, who bought land because it was going up so fast in value. And the Federal Land Bank loaned to you on the value of the land, not on your ability to repay. And for those of you who couldn't repay, you then saw the land go down to 50% of the value you paid for it. I have the honor for my family of having bought 70 acres in Tippecanoe County at the height of the market. Economists are supposed to tell you where the tops and the bottoms are. I told all my neighbors where the top was. There's a bronze plaque out there where I did it. And my wife works still today for the Federal Land Bank. That means she doesn't go to their office. She works at an off-farm job so she can make the payments for us. Now, this was not caused by a farm bill. This was caused by budget concerns and fiscal policy. And I'll argue with you that if we ever get to the point in the next couple of years where Congress admits that we have a deficit, and actually tries to do something about it, all hell's going to break loose. Let me just run through a few of the numbers. The president was all excited about reforming Social Security. If you look at the budget numbers 8-10 years down the road, Social Security's not the big deal. Medicare, Medicaid is. Medicare, Medicaid becomes the 800-pound gorilla. We're talking about something that's going to eat up, approaching half the federal budget. And we're not talking that far away. And if you look at our state budgets for Illinois, for Indiana, Ohio, most of the states across the country, it's the Medicaid budget that's killing us. And these are things that are going to have to be dealt with, or else we're going to be in real trouble. Why is this important? Number one, well, of course, all of us have different views. I like the idea that I spend like mad and my kids will have to pay it back. I think that's the way to live. Now, of course, my kids have solved that problem. My son is working in Sweden, and my daughter's husband is with her in Australia, so they've, you know, just solved it that way. If we're dealing with a continuing budget deficit, it is something that eventually is going to have to bring us to higher interest rates. You combine that with the trade deficit, and attempts to keep the value of the dollar where it is now. And we're talking about some real pain in terms of potential interest rates. You're also talking about a situation that if you look at the longer-term deficit and we don't start our path out of the deficit, if we go ahead and extend the Bush tax cuts, the deficit line just keeps getting worse and worse. The only thing currently that will begin to bring us out of a deficit situation is if we do not extend the Bush tax cuts. None of you wants to pay higher taxes. We now have a political perception by the congressmen, and they're right, that if they ever do anything that can even be accused of increasing a tax, you'll send them in retirement and they'll have to sell used cars again. That causes a real problem for the country, because the other thing is that you are absolutely unwilling to reduce any expenditure. Now, we can talk about reducing Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits. And the only way you're going to deal with a budget deficit of this size is by fighting and reducing in those three categories. How many of you are willing to substantially reduce defense so our kids over in Iraq won't have bullets, let alone proper equipment? Okay, we're not going to reduce the defense budget. How many of you are willing to reduce the interest on the government debt so all of you who have treasury bills will take less money? Okay. My mother feels strongly about this. She'll celebrate her 100th birthday in May. Part of her income is from T-bills. She is still very active. She reads the newspaper every day, annotates it, and sends it to me so I read the right stuff. And if Congress even suggests cutting Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, or the interest on the debt, my mother will put on her sneakers, catch Amtrak to Washington, and beat her congressman senseless with her umbrella. Okay? This is what we're dealing with in this country. But if you don't come out of it in one way or another, we've got real trouble. How does this affect the farm bill? If Congress discovers we have a deficit, before they write the next farm bill, they're going to have to make some serious cuts. There's just no question about it. Everyone's going to have to take their share. If they keep the rose-colored glasses on until beyond that point, the deficit isn't going to be a major player. But at some point down the road, Congress can pass a law which can change some of the rules of the game on the farm bill coming up or on the coming year when you sign that contract every year. All right? And they're going to have to do that. There's just no question about that. For the financial health of the country, for your ability to borrow at reasonable interest rates, for just dealing with paying for the services that we all demand and not putting it off on our children, the budget is the issue, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, now let me just say a couple words about ethanol policy. If you have a 50-million-gallon ethanol plant today that cost you about $70 million to build, at current ethanol, natural gas, and corn prices, that plant this year, before the government subsidy, on the basis of the market, will make you $30 million. You add the government subsidy, another $25 million, and that makes $55 million. You wonder why people are so eager to invest in ethanol? That's a $70 million investment. It's going to yield you $55 million. I would even be willing to put, you know, all my mother's money in that. All right? That's where the ethanol industry is. Let me remind you, again, if we discover that we have a budget deficit, how willing are the taxpayers going to be to continue giving this plant a $25 million annual subsidy if they're already making $30 million? The ethanol industry doesn't want to talk about this issue. I wonder why. But I think it would be by far the wisest thing for the ethanol industry to go to Congress right now and say we want a subsidy on a sliding scale, like an LDP. Okay, if the profit margin goes way down to zero, then the subsidy cuts in. I think we're going to have to think about those sorts of things. Secondly, we are going to have ethanol from biomass. If you take the whole corn crop, forget about the piggies, forget about the grits, put it into ethanol, you're talking about replacing maybe 20-plus percent of our gasoline usage, and we import 60% of it. Okay? Ethanol is not going to relieve us from the Arabs. Soy diesel, if you take all the soybean oil plus the grease and tallow, you'll maybe get 5 to 8% of the diesel usage. Okay? These things are not going to solve our problems. If you want to look where you can get the most bang for your buck now, investing to help us become energy dependent, it would be passing a law that increases the mandatory fuel standards, the CAFE standards, in terms of vehicle efficiency. If we increased vehicle efficiency, the Congressional Accounting Office tells us to increase it 10% would cost us $3.6 billion. Okay? When we get up to 7.5 billion gallons of ethanol, which is 5%, that is going to cost us in subsidies $3.8 billion. So for $3.8 billion in subsidies, okay, we get a 5% ethanol replacement. For $3.6 billion to pay the consumers for the more expensive car and to pay the automobile company to make it more efficient, we get a 10% saving, and that is about 14-plus billion gallons. Let me stop there. Bob wants to talk about some of the things directly, more closely related to the farm bill itself, and then we welcome discussion on this.
Thank you very much, Otto. I'm going to stay over here. You all left your guns at home, right? Okay. Bob Thompson is with us, too, this morning to talk about farm policy. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. It's great to see so many friends in Indiana here this morning. You know, I spent 20 years at Purdue, and now I'm over at the University of Illinois, and so it's really great to reconnect with so many folks. Looking towards the 2007 Farm Bill, you know, a betting person would have to bet that the next farm bill will look a lot like the 2002 farm bill. Farmers love the 2002 farm bill. Members of Congress are hearing from their farmers up and down the gravel roads of rural America, just keep it coming. We like it just like it is. We never change farm policy very fast from one farm bill to the next. And if you don't believe those reasons for keeping the next farm bill fairly similar to this one, rural politics, or national politics, has played out in rural areas. Who reelected George Bush to his second term in Congress? Rural America. His support in urban areas declined from the first to the second election. It increased in rural America. And if you were Karl Rove advising the president on what or how strong he ought to get out in front, arguing for reducing the money flowing to rural America, I think he'd say, don't touch it with a 10-foot pole. We want to keep Republican control of the House and the Senate. We want to keep the White House. Don't rock the boat. On the other hand, Democrats aren't going to get out in front asking to cut money going to rural America because they'd like to pick up a few of those votes. both in the presidential election as well as the House and Senate election. So politics also, I think, will push in the direction of retaining the status quo or something close to it. But this time, perhaps more than any farm bill in recent memory, there are more forces pushing for bigger change than normal from one farm bill to the next. Otto's talked about the deficit. Maybe Congress will wake up and confront the reality that we have a deficit. But the farm bill that I worked when I was Assistant Secretary of Agriculture in 1985 was passed the same year that we passed the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Act, when Congress really got serious about doing something against the deficit that we had at that time. Despite the fact that they passed the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Act, which took a meat axe to federal expenditures, we passed the farm bill with the highest authorized spending in history. So don't count on the budget deficit causing a reduction in dollars flowing to rural America. The trade negotiations. Here's where I think there is potential to have some greater impact on future farm policy. Exports are important to American agriculture. We export between a quarter and a third of everything we produce. Without that volume of exports, American agriculture and associated businesses would have to be a lot smaller. That's less land in production, it's less people on the farm, and it's certainly a lot less employment in the associated industries. So there is a great deal of concern about increasing market access in markets that we've historically shipped our agricultural products to. There's also a lot of concern about growing the markets in low-income countries where people have not yet gotten enough purchasing power to consume much meat, fruits, vegetables, or edible oils. We talk a lot about increasing market access, and American farm organizations are on record saying we will accept reduction in our trade-distorting domestic subsidies if we get, and if and only if, we get a big increase in market access overseas. The administration offered on October 10th in the WTO to fully phase out trade-distorting agricultural subsidies in 15 years with a 60% cut in the cap that we accepted in the last round of trade negotiations over the first 5 years. Now, because it's the cap and not the actual subsidies that is proposed to cut, that actually would translate into about a 15% reduction in what we're getting right now. In exchange for doing that, the administration said, though, we have to get a big cut in tariffs in other countries, a big increase in market access. And this is what drew the Europeans up short. They have some reform of their agricultural policy underway that's to be completed by 2013. And if they were to reduce their tariffs, they'd have to accelerate their agricultural policy reform significantly. And as we all read in the newspapers last fall, President Chirac in France called up the European Union's trade negotiator, accused him of exceeding his negotiating mandate, and stopped the process dead. Up until now, the manufacturing and services sectors of France, which have a lot more to gain than agriculture has to lose, have not put much pressure on Chirac. So in terms of the negotiations in the WTO bringing about this significant change, I think 50-50 chance of this actually happening. President Bush's negotiating authority expires July 1st next year. And we've been at this for 5 years, and if we don't soon make some progress, the clock is simply going to run out, because there's an awful lot of detail to be worked out in the tariff schedules once we agree on general principles. So the negotiations themselves in the WTO, I think maybe a 50-50 chance of getting a significant change right now. And if we don't get it done by July 1, 2007, about the same time we write the Farm Bill, I think it'll be at least the second or third year of the next president's term before we can get the negotiations going again. But there's another way the WTO could indeed influence future farm policy in this country. We have to remember that if these negotiations fail, the Uruguay Round Agreement on Agriculture, which was struck in the last round of negotiations, will be the set of rules by which international agricultural trade will be functioning. There will be no peace clause that protects us from litigation against our current farm programs. The cotton program, which was found to be WTO illegal last year, has many of the same attributes as our corn, soybean, wheat, and rice for the, and other feed grains programs. I think there's a very significant risk that we would lose through litigation at least LDPs and probably the whole marketing loan LDP and countercyclical payment structure and get nothing for it if we lose in litigation and have to pay a fine to boot because we're violating the international trade rules that, parenthetically, we wrote. The U.S. was the principal author of the last round of trade negotiations agreement. WTO negotiations reach agreement by consensus. This is not one of those international organizations where a whole bunch of little countries gang up in the United States and ram something down our throats. We wrote the current rules of the road of international trade, and those are the rules of the road against which our cotton program was sized up. So I think there's a significant risk if we don't change the way we distribute money in the next farm bill. We don't negotiate them away in the WTO negotiations so we get something for them, we'll lose them through litigation. Last point I would make about the future farm policy and things pushing change. There's been a significant erosion of public support for farm programs in urban America. There's increasing recognition that the payments tend to be concentrated in the hands of the bigger producers. There's recognition that only one-third of American agriculture benefits from farm programs. There's also recognition that there's a huge disparity among regions of the country and among commodities in terms of how much farmers get. So we've got a lot of fragmentation of the historical solidarity within agriculture opening up. So if there is a binding budget constraint, I think there's going to be significant warfare among different commodities competing for the available money. Last point. Farm bills, when they're written, are mainly reflective of the current economic conditions in agricultural markets, the current financial condition of American agriculture. So while we can't know today what the current market conditions will be in 2007, whatever they are is likely to have a pronounced impact on the farm bill that we get written in 2007. I don't think we'll see an extension of 2002 farm bill so that we don't write a farm bill in 2007. I think there will be one written then. And the biggest question, I think, there is not how much money is going to be cut out of farm programs, but the mechanism by which it's distributed. Will we continue to distribute a significant amount in proportion to how much we produce and sell, or will we change to a less trade-distorting format, move to more direct payments, or to more public investments in things like research, conservation, rural development? I think that's the biggest question that will be confronting both the Congress and the administration in the next farm bill.
Let me see if I've got this right, and I'm going to try to put a spin on the two of you together. So if I think about this historically, we were worried about the WTO, but it may be the Uruguay round that actually writes the next farm bill, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. When the United States put that together under the previous Bush administration, if I remember correctly, 1992, mm-hmm. is that the right year?
Yep, 10 years ago.
Yeah, 1992. And we have a Secretary of Ag that in the last day and a half has been talking about meeting obligations on the world stage. And previous to that has said the Bush administration is going to take an active role this time around, unlike the last time around, in writing the farm bill. And they have all the red states in their corner. So the question then is, right? So the question is, how is this going to change? Because I'm quite certain that none of these guys really want to give up a check in their mailbox, relatively speaking. But they're not going to get the cash flow, it doesn't look like, in the coming farm bill, because that'll be going into the places that you're talking about. And Otto, do you agree with him that this will be the places that'll go, we'll look at, and they might get out of conservation, correct?
I think when you think about alternative ways the dollars might flow, you got to look at a map of what you might call the current geography of payments. Okay, where do the payments go now geographically? And then you've got to ask yourself, would these other things people are talking about still have the same geography of payments? And by geography, I mean geography. I mean county by county, state by state. Then you also think, those people who are getting it now are going to fight like tigers to keep it. Those people who aren't getting it now might like it, but they got to be bigger than the tigers who are fighting to keep it. And if you look at current farm programs and what we've done, and you look at the money that we've sent to the Midwest, basically for corn and soybeans in recent years, there is no conservation program that's going to bring you that volume of money, because frankly, I have great difficulty giving a lot of money to Benton County for soil conservation. Okay? And the same would be right around Champaign-Urbana. The erosion problems are not tremendous. Maybe we've got some water quality problems. But how, if you are going to maintain the same geography of payments, you can't do it with the other programs that are being talked about.
What are the options then? And I might add that we have, I think we still have a PowerPoint from May that you have with the geography of payments on it,
so.
County by county. It's still, you can still access it on the WILLag.org website, and it shows payments in the South, to the cotton producers,
yes,
in particular,
cotton
that are fairly
rice.
Large, cotton and rice. So, but given that, what are the options for producers in those two counties that keep money flowing into those counties, and does it flow through the producer or somewhere else?
I think the only way you keep a relatively homogeneous or relatively consistent geographic distribution of payments is to convert our historical recent historical base, as the new base for direct payments, and so it would be direct payments rather than LDPs and countercyclical payments. I think that's the only hope of keeping consistent pattern of payments with what we've got now. Certainly investing in rural infrastructure, investing in research, investing in conservation, those may be important investments for the greater good of the future of American agriculture, but they aren't going to keep the distribution of payments going to individual producers.
And what Bob is saying, recognize here, is that it is the mechanism of the LDP and the countercyclical that is the problem, that is the trade distorting problem. And so in essence, we would have to move to a payment that does not affect how much you grow and what you grow. And the direct payments so far have, to some extent, met that target. However, you know, we had the direct payment back in the 96 Farm Bill. Prices fell out of bed. You didn't like it. So we got a 2002 Farm Bill that brought back all the old payment stuff from before, all the countercyclical stuff, plus a little direct payment. And you love that because you get it both ways. Okay? And so, you know, listen to what he's saying in this.
Considering that following the wars, they've usually increased the money flow to help balance the budget, and the funds seem to be throwing money at the commodities and different sources, and they're running the printing presses, and the newest appointee is supposed to run the printing presses full bore. How do you counter that?
I guess my reading of our new chairman of the Fed is that we still have someone who's something of an inflation fighter. I don't think at this point we're going to run the printing presses like mad and get in an inflationary high interest regime fairly quickly. I am very concerned about the fact that the whole budget for the whole expenditure for Iraq is off budget. You guys, some of you may not have seen this, but it is not part of the budget deficit. We are funding Iraq through emergency appropriations that come every so often to Congress, and they aren't officially on the budget. And that expenditure is now up in the $300 to $400 billion range. That worries me.
Just to pursue this deficit issue just a step further, because it ties in directly to the trade or the future trade prospects, and that is, last year Americans were dissavers. Net savings in the United States was negative. We spent more than we earned. Credit card debt continues to explode. The federal government's running at least a $400 billion deficit, as Otto indicates, without counting the war in Iraq and the full costs of recovering from the hurricanes in the south. We're borrowing, the U.S. government is borrowing, more than $2 billion per day, and the two principal buyers, the governments of China and Japan. You wonder why we don't have more political leverage against the government in Beijing? They're our principal banker. We're not going to push too hard. The administration will shout and holler for the American media, but they're not going to push that hard in Beijing because they're our principal source they're the principal market for our T-bills every day in excess of $2 billion. So then the next point, if you assume that at some point in the future we're going to have to start paying down that international debt, then we're going to have to run a trade surplus. We're running a huge trade deficit right now. So in the long term, it's good news for American agriculture because the dollar will be extremely weak, perhaps collapse when the day of reckoning comes, and our cost of living will go through the ceiling, of course, because we're living on so much imported goods that cost very little, because the policy that we have right now of borrowing $2 billion a day is totally swamping the impact of international trade in the foreign exchange markets, and that's what's holding the dollar so strong.
How have New Zealand farmers survived for almost 20 years without government subsidies, and is it likely to happen here?
Let me talk while Bob thinks on this one, and then he can come and tell you the real answer. And we should go Mutt and Jeff on some of these. We had the fortune of spending some time with a number of the big New Zealand co-ops when the New Zealand made that decision, and then watching them go through it. They took a tremendous amount of pain initially in terms of land values, in terms of a whole mess of other things. I mean, they really took some pain. And I think the other thing to realize is that they are not a major world producer of the commodities they're dealing with, okay? So they're not in a position to affect markets very much one way or another. And they've never been in that position. And as you look at the New Zealand situation in dairy, they've been able to go out and find some real niches in Asia and Southeast Asia and develop some markets that are really very good for themselves. So two things. They took a heck of a hit initially, okay? Look out at you. Let me bring down your land value for really good Champaign-Urbana, Benton County land to about $1,700 an acre. Let me bring land rents down accordingly, and you'll make some money.
Yeah, I think that Otto's hit the nail on the head. There was a lot of pain during the transition, but I've had the privilege of two or three visits to New Zealand over the last 5 years, and New Zealand agriculture has never been more entrepreneurial and more profitable than it is today. And entrepreneurial zeal that was unleashed by getting away from having to produce the commodities that the government was supporting in order to get the government support. That was the most impressive change in New Zealand, the entrepreneurship. You know, the whole venison meat industry developed. They stimulated a lot of investment in wine grapes. There's an awful lot of rural tourism, bed and breakfast, to diversify the income sources in the farm households. That's what's most impressive. But in terms of your question, will American agriculture have to go cold turkey? I don't think so. In fact, I don't think there'll be a reduction in the amount of, or at least very much of a reduction in the amount of money going to rural America, but rather in the manner in which it's transferred to rural America. I certainly don't expect any increase, though.
As we close out, could you both take a couple of minutes, just two and outline, if you could, a prediction for what the 2007 Farm Bill might look like in your world, not in the real world, but in your world if it were to work. Otto?
Now are you saying what we would like it to be?
Or? Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Remember, when you elect me czar, everything will be great, except like Stalin did to Soviet agriculture, he'll set it back 50 years. I would like to see us do something that allows us to bring land values down. And what this basically would have to be would be a slow reduction in those payments that get capitalized into the value of land. And I guess what I would like to see is something like the Lugar Plan that he proposed in 1994 that was dead on arrival, where there were a range of cuts over time, or things where you base it on average prices for the last 5 years and work down from a point like that. I think we have to get these lowered, because my main concern is the extent to which we bid this income into the price of land, and therefore the operators no better off. Now, those of you who are about to retire are better off. And that's one reason I say if you're going to do this, you don't go cold turkey. You take it down very gradually and make the signals very clear.
Yeah, I think that to bring off a change, you've got to neutralize the political opposition from those commodities that are receiving the largest payments right now. And so I was set in motion a process by which we did go from payments that are linked to the production of specific commodities to decoupled payments that are based on a historical production pattern. This will also blunt the pain of adjustment in land prices. You wouldn't precipitate a land price debacle. In effect, those direct payments in some sense could be almost argued as a land price support program to blunt the pain of adjustment there. I think we're significantly underinvesting in the long-term health of American agriculture. We're not putting nearly enough into infrastructure. The locks and dams come to mind immediately on the Mississippi. Getting broadband internet into every rural community. There are a number of areas where our infrastructure is impeding economic development in rural areas. I sense that a lot of producers think that the pendulum swung too far in relying on the private sector for most of our agriculture research and future technology, and that we ought to redress that imbalance. So I'd put a little more money into public support for agriculture research. And I do think that in the WTO negotiations, it would be easy to get an agreement with other countries, particularly Europe, to put more money into conservation and environmental support. So shift money out of LDPs, countercyclical payments, and marketing loans in general. And last thing that should be considered, I think, as an alternative in the longer term might be some kind of a revenue insurance program, such as the Illinois Farm Bureau proposed at their annual convention back in December. But we need to study the Canadian experience more and probably start it as a pilot project rather than going whole hog.
Speaking of the Canadian experience, you mentioned to me this morning that there was an event that I should cover in April and that these folks might be invited to.
On April 6th, we're having Doug Headley come down to give a seminar in the Agricultural Economics Department. It'll be a public seminar in the library building at University of Illinois. Doug was the senior civil servant in Agriculture Canada who was the closest policy advisor to a series of ministers of agriculture. He was through the entire range of experiments that Canadians have tried with revenue insurance, and we've asked him to come down and talk about that range of experiences, what worked, what didn't, and what lessons he would draw for future farm policy in the United States. Doug retired this last year, so he's free to speak his mind and tell it like it was. And I think it'll be an ideal opportunity for producers who are interested in hearing more about what the Canadian experience was, as well as for our students and faculty on campus.
We'll try.
So everybody's welcome. October 6th, 3:30 in the afternoon.
Not October.
not a, April. April 6th.
April 6th, 3:30 in the afternoon in the library building at University of Illinois.
The ACES Library?
ACES Library.
The ACES Library, which is next to Mumford Hall on
octagonal
campus.
Octagonal building.
Yeah. So, and I'll try to remind you during the closing mark report from time to time about that, and certainly in our weekend newsletter. How many of you subscribe to that weekend newsletter, by the way? Okay, good. If you haven't subscribed, you ought to pick that up. Dave Dickey does a magnificent, and I mean Dave does a magnificent job. I don't write very much of the weekend newsletter at all. Dave does all of that. So if you enjoy that letter, and there are about 1,700 on the list, congratulate that man over there, your director of ag programming at the station, because he does more work on that letter than you can imagine. It takes me a little while to put it back in order over the weekend just so graphically it looks right, but Dave does a heck of a job. Dave, thanks much for that. And speaking of Dave, he's going to come up right now and tell you just exactly how we're going to go through the lunch lines. By the way, give a big hand to these two guys up here. Thank you very much. Otto Doering is an ag economist at Purdue University. Thank you for coming down. And Bob Thompson from the University of Illinois. We appreciate it, gentlemen. Thank you very much today.